Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Doomberg and Ira Harris. Doomberg operates a Substack and subscription newsletter. It's now number one finance Substack in the finance category in the world. Started in May of 2021 to highlight the fundamentals missing from many economic and policy decisions. Quickly has grown to be one of the most widely read finance newsletters on Substack. And Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003 and a stint most recently. Welcome, Doomberg and Ira.
Well, thank you, Richard. Thank you, Doomberg.
Thank you, Richard. And Ira, it's great to be back. It's our second conversation, and lots have happened since we last connected. So looking forward to getting caught up.
I'm old enough, so now I kind of feel like I'm with the dugout wizard. That's what was that called? Tommy Lasorda and the San Diego Chicken. So, never go to war against the San Diego Chicken. You're a loser. So, thanks.
Since our last podcast program show, Doomberg, would you like to update your latest thinking on the economy and the financial markets, the macro view?
Yeah, I think obviously the big issue right now is Europe getting ready for the winter, which we discussed last time. And you know, there's a lot of debate on financial Twitter about whether perhaps storage levels of natural gas or the slowly lowering price of natural gas in Europe means that perhaps the crisis was overblown. I think we're past the primary energy phase of the crisis, and now we're going to start to see the downstream impacts of what has already transpired in late Q3 when things got really out of control. And so, you know, we're already seeing some perturbations in the sovereign debt market and currencies, and you know, the crisis in the UK and Japan's battle of the yen, which is a piece we wrote about since we last talked. You know, all these things we believe are echoes of the damage that was done by the skyrocketing energy prices, which are still very elevated, albeit down from the top for sure. And so, yeah, that's our focus right now, is kind of finding, you know, downstream. What does this mean for the economy? What does it mean for growth? What does it mean for the Fed and whether it'll pivot? All the same questions that everybody's pondering and trying to wrap their heads around.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
I'm right there. And it's interesting that we start off with that, because, you know, what I was thinking and talking about today is the lowering of the price of the Dutch LNG market a storage issue more than anything else? I know all those ships are backed up. And so, almost like we saw in when was that, April of 2021? Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm deferring to you.
No, sorry. Our view is you know, ultimately once the tanks get stored, then you have to get through the winter. And, you know, they had a cold snap a couple of weeks ago. The weather has turned a bit warm. You know, the day-to-day price of natural gas is interesting. And as you said, a storage issue, you know, we put a piece out where we showed, like, you know, 90% storage in one country doesn't mean 90% storage in a different country. It depends on how much capacity you actually have to store natural gas. So for example, the United Kingdom can only store 1%. And so having its storage tanks be 100% full is perfectly meaningless. But Germany is more like 23, 24, I think, round numbers. And so them being at 90-95% storage is a very good thing. And we should say, credit where credit is due, the Germans have finally relented and have agreed to keep their three remaining nuclear power plants on. It's shocking it took this long. And the piece we're going to put out tomorrow is about what Germany should do with the three. It just shut down last year. We have a piece called A Decent Proposal that we're going to put out. And we like our titles over at Doomberg. So, you know, the price of natural gas couldn't stay that high, especially the price of electricity. You know, a year ahead, electricity in Germany has skyrocketed to, I think, 1,000 euros per megawatt. And as we're talking, I'm just going to pull up my my Bloomberg terminal and see where we are today. Lots of celebrating on FinTwit that perhaps the worst has passed, but I think the price is still roughly around 400 euros per megawatt hour, which is roughly, 10 times the price it was 2 years ago. So, you know, it's not 1,000 and it couldn't stay at 1,000, but it's not 40 either. And it's around 388 to 400 I see on my screen.
Now, is there still gas supplies coming in to Europe being stored? Like, could, I heard reports of next winter, not this winter, next winter could be worse because of...
Yeah. So a lot of the storage that is in place today came from Russia, and with the destruction of Nord Stream 1 and at least the partial destruction of Nord Stream 2. The only remaining supplies from Russia via pipeline run through the Ukraine and Belarus. And so it's a precarious time. And so, yes, this winter is tough, and then they get to do it all over again. But this time with a couple of more hands tied behind their backs. If you look at the futures curve, the forward pricing of Dutch TTF looks about two more tough winters for Europe. And that is kind of in line with industry estimates for this massive build out of LNG import and export capacity. And one of the things that we tweeted about, I believe, is the world's never seen a truly global natural gas market. And when this crisis is over, and it will end, we will have a truly global natural gas market. It'll trade in a thicker wedge than oil or coal, because the shipping costs are going to be a little higher. But how much intra-market penetration do you need to have a truly efficient, arbitrageable market? It's not that much. My gut says 15% to 20% would do it in most circumstances. And so the world is going to be very different when this crisis is done. Obviously, when people say, "Will Europe survive the winter?" I don't think anybody thought that there would be millions of people freezing. But economically, what does survive mean? Is minus 5% contraction a catastrophe? We think it is.
Is the nuclear situation, is that in Germany, is it quickly able to come back online for those three reactors, or does that take a period?
When you think about the Herculean efforts they're doing to find every joule of energy around the world, it would seem that the most prolific and talented engineering economy in the world could figure out how to restart some reactors. I don't think they went and blew them up. And I think there's a lot of propaganda around this where the Greens have tried to make it seem like an impossible challenge. I think they're flat out lying. I do think that the German engineering capacity is more than capable of restarting reactors. And in our piece, so there's this crazy deal. I don't know how much you want to get into it, but between Canada and Germany, where they're proposing to ship hydrogen from Newfoundland to Germany, which is just about the dumbest idea we've ever come across. And so the plan is they're going to make wind turbines. They're going to put in transmission lines. Then they're going to build giant electrolyzers to make hydrogen. And some people say they're going to ship that, but you can't ship hydrogen. The technology doesn't exist and won't exist for a long time. So what they're going to do then, I guess, is they're going to build new brand new Haber-Bosch plants, make ammonia, and then ship that. And our proposal in a decent proposal is that why don't you just skip all those extra steps and turn on the nuclear reactors just to make ammonia, carbon-free ammonia in Germany. You have ammonia plants that are suffering significant disadvantage because of the natural gas price, and you have these mothballed nuclear power plants. Why, you don't need to ship it. It's all right there. All you really need to do is build out the hydrogen infrastructure, and you could sell it as a giant green hydrogen pilot plant. And that would be the face-saving way for the Greens to allow more energy to hit the grid. And you could use the LNG that would have gone to make ammonia to heat homes or to produce electricity. And so it's all very fungible, of course. And so our proposal is very, very simple compared to this, Rube Goldberg contraption that Trudeau and Schultz proposed back in August. This is far, far simpler, makes way too much sense. And therefore, it's probably never going to happen.
Interesting. Your thoughts, Ira?
I'm laughing because since the last time we've been on, I actually just finished reading Vaclav Smil, How the World Really Works. And here's somebody who, to me, I hate to use the word, but in deference to you, Doomberg, is as green as anybody. And he talks about the importance of how long this is a process. That's what these producers of platitudes don't understand. It's a process. And I love that Smil takes the world and breaks it into four major components, right? Plastics, concrete, steel, and ammonia. And you know what? All heavily imbued with energy. And the cost of that energy is significant. And how so? You just cannot wave a wand. Yeah, you know, as I say very derisively, you know, when you're living off your trust fund and you go down into the post office and pick up the check on a monthly basis, everything looks so simple, right? I get my organic vegetables at Whole Foods. I buy this here, I buy that. And you know what? We should just, you know, and as easy as my life is, that's the way that we should transition. Well, there is no, they don't want to transition. The transition is going to be, as you've pointed out, you guys do it better than anybody. It has been, it's going to take time because there's just not enough money in the world in the next, in their limited time scale. There's just, because time and money are very important and who's going to bear the brunt of it. Here we are, and I think it's a really good takeoff point. But I think the point you make is very well. And let's go back to Trudeau, who's just, here's another person who could have brought Canada so far forward during this crisis, but he gets caught in his own rhetoric, and he's probably representative as much as anybody with these platitudes. And he's got Chrystia Freelander on top of it, who I've never been a fan of, even when she wrote for the FT. So right. They're just caught in this. And Canada should be booming in so many ways. But no.
Yeah, I mean, like, what are your thoughts, Newberg, on the math, like the
the
economic viability and also the overall carbon emissions? Because, you know, unless, as you mentioned, you do it through, wind, solar, or pink hydrogen, right, with nuclear, if you do the math, it's actually worse, right, on the climate.
Well, here's the thing. Forget about money. So I was saying that there's not enough money. Actually, there's not enough BTUs. So if you stop thinking about money, and you think about new energy developments just in form of BTUs, what is the energy payback period, not the financial payback period? So these are hyperpolitical numbers, of course, because the renewable crowd knows that this is their point of maximum weakness, and so they just make up numbers. But if we're very generous and we say it takes a one-year payback for solar, you know, the amount of energy that you have to put in to convert sand into, you know, solar-grade polysilicon is known, measurable. It's bounded by thermodynamics. Like, these processes are well understood. That energy has to come from somewhere. And so, like any discounted cash flow, if we do a discounted joule flow, if you have to invest a full, you know, 1 year's worth of energy before that energy gets paid back from developing solar, then by definition, you can't convert 5% of your energy grid without, you know, diverting 5% of your energy from other sources. And where are those sources going to come from? The elasticity demand for energy is such that, people were willing to pay a lot for the clearing price. And if you divert 5% away, now, if you look at nuclear power, the energy payback period, because nuclear energy is so energy dense, is 6 weeks. So if you do the math, what that means is if you divert 1% of your global energy budget, you can switch 9% of your energy grid in 1 year. And so it's literally, you know, it's 45 times better. I mean, it's insane. I'm sure somebody will correct us on the math, but so, you know, where does the energy come from is this sort of perpetual motion machine type analysis that people put out there. Like, again, just think about this cockamamie project off the coast of Newfoundland. The number of windmills that are going to be needed to produce a meaningful amount of ammonia is huge. And each of those windmills contains steel, epoxy, rare earth metals that are sourced exclusively in China. The gearboxes are very complex. You know, it's a lot of materials. And so the energy payback period is very long, and that energy needs to be paid now. Like, you can't take a loan out on the BTUs required to make the steel that's going to stand up these wind turbines. So the difference between that and natural gas or oil is that you drill for it and it's there. So the energy payback period is infinite, basically. And with nuclear, there is a certain penalty, but it's not much. And because of the energy density of uranium, yes, you have to like build the plant, but the fuel is so de minimis that the energy payback period is quite rapid.
Your thoughts, Ira?
No, you can't argue with it. The maths are the maths. And then again, you look at, and nuclear is, again, was always the greatest transition mechanism, especially because you already had so much investment into it, you know, and again, fixed investment into the nuclear world mandated that you keep these plants really, and German engineering and Japanese engineering, you know, the Japanese, of course, got caught with Fukushima, but they're turning them back on too. But their engineering is so high caliber the ability to maintain these made perfect sense. But you know, we always come back to Gerhard Schroeder, don't we? And the move away from nuclear in 01, 02, 03, even before. So, you know, as he was tying Germany to a cheap Russian natural gas. So, I mean, these were all afoot. And then, of course, Merkel sealed the deal because she thought, you know, she didn't want to get caught off with, you know, and possibly lose power, especially after Fukushima. And I don't, that's no pun, I'm sorry, to lose political power. She certainly has lost energy power, but she moved aggressively to secure that vote in order to keep the conservatives in power. And believe me, having her in power was no great shakes, as you can see the damage that was done. And I don't care how many times she appears on Time Magazine as a person of the year or whatever, untold damage to Germany and I hope we get into this, into Europe, because I think Europe and the funding of all this becomes very interesting. And hopefully so when we look at all of this, right, with what's going on in the world, well, Richard, I'll see where you're going to take us here before I go down that route. So yeah, that's all I'll say about this.
You're on mute, Richard.
I'm on mute.
Richard is okay.
Oh, Richard.
Can't hear you, Richard. There you go.
Everybody.
There you go.
Nope. Yeah, you disappeared, Richard.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah, we'll edit that out. Sorry about that.
It must have been the Canadian. It must have been the Canadian government.
Yeah, exactly.
they froze your podcast instead of your bank account.
Sorry, I think you were saying prior, if you can continue. Ira, you were mentioning something.
Now we're going to get into the financing of Europe, which I think is very important, because my jump off point is this. While the U.S. curves are inverting, right, and European rates are going higher, of course, they're not going higher necessarily because the ECB is not being nearly as active as the Fed, but the European curves have been steepening. So you have two dramatically differential views here, but that are signaling something. What are they signaling? I think that's worth the discussion, because that should be catching every, you know, and even Joe Biden in the ice cream store should understand that, you know, a stronger dollar is, a different issue. But I think it's truly reflected in when you see those yield curves.
Yeah, I would add that, you know, when we talk about the second and third order effects of the energy crisis, the world now knows that the yen and the pound and the euro, these aren't governments that can settle their energy needs in their domestic currencies yet. And so most of the world's energy is still cleared in US dollars, which is putting extreme pressure on these currencies. And I think we're watching the yen very closely. You know, it's a race to the bottom between Japan and Britain right now. Situation in Britain seems to have stabilized a little bit, but we'll see how long Truss lasts if she holds on. But, you know, the yen at 149 this morning after the BOJ all but drew a line in the sand at 145 is pretty interesting to us. They're kind of they're swimming against the current here and trying to stay as loose as they can while keeping the currency under control. So we shall see. But in Britain and with the euro, you know, well below par, this is, we think, a consequence of the fact that the world knows that they can't print energy, but they're still acting as though that they can. You know, the amount of stimulus going out to offset the damage to the local citizenry, which is totally understandable, but also we think, you know, backwards policy, that's not going to facilitate a sufficient level of demand destruction needed to rationally partition their limited molecules ahead of this winter. And then, like we said earlier, they just get to do it all over again. And so if you look at a friend, Alfonso over at Macro Alf, has a great mental model for this, which is, I see that we lost him. Still recording though.
Okay, keep going.
Yeah, our friend Alfonso over at Macro Alf has a great mental model for this, which is you could view the UK as an emerging market undergoing an exogenic shock in the sense that their energy needs are basically US dollar denominated foreign debts, and they can't print US dollars. And, Grant Williams had a great letter this month called Anarchy in the UK, his monthly newsletter, Things That Make You Go, Ooh, Murray. He tells the story of the last time that the UK was bailed out, and many people forget this, but they were actually bailed out by the IMF almost 50 years ago. And, history is certainly repeating itself here.
Well, and actually, I would argue that where people have missed it, Brexit is now a very positive force because the UK does not bear responsibility for the ECB. And I'll argue all day long that the ECB is close to another existential decision here. Because again, how much will the Germans take, right? Are they going to be good Europeans, or are they going to, we're always caught between the Westphalian model of the nation state, regionalism and globalism. And how much will the German taxpayer be willing to bear to continue to sustain the ECB? Because let's face it, without the German credit card, the interest rate costs in Europe would be phenomenally higher. We'd be back to 2011 and 2012, maybe worse, by the way, maybe worse. So this is a very, very important issue. And interestingly, after the last ECB meeting, Christine Lagarde, who's been under great stress, and you could see it in all the people who are now coming out and talking. You know, I'm talking about Nagel, Nat, Holtzman. They're all very, very hawkish on the short term part, and wanted to get into quantitative tightening on top of it. So Christine Lagarde, after the last press conference, was who had to swallow a bigger rate rise than she wanted, but she was very clear in letting everybody know that quantitative tightening hadn't even been discussed. So it seemed to me pretty evident that there was a trade-off, that Lagarde was willing to go to higher short-term overnight rates as long as quantitative tightening. Because once quantitative tightening really begins in Europe, then that whole concept of fragmentation is going to be in play in a very dramatic fashion. So she's really got a very dangerous situation here. And as the German economy continues to turn down, why? Because they're not getting cheap natural gas. Without cheap natural gas, the German economic engine doesn't perform as well. Now, others may think, like Macron probably thinks that's a good thing because it elevates France. It's always a problem since De Gaulle's famous line that Europe is Germany and France, and the rest are just the trimmings. But we're going to see, because there's a lot more trimmings to deal with, and there are a lot more variables in play. But this is a very, very dangerous time coming, and you can see the capitulation. And it's a good thing for Germany with their with the coalition that Lindner is the finance minister, because I think the Free Democrats at least have some leverage here, and we're probably most responsible for that the recent decision on the nuclear power plants, because I think Lindner has been in favor of that always. The Free Democrats, you know, they're about liberal capitalism, free market capitalism to whatever that exists. And in Germany, that's never an easy sell, but I think they're on there. But I think this Europe, and nothing tells me more than what's going on in the European yield curves.
The only thing I would add is because I agree with everything you said is, obviously, like everybody else, we watch the spreads to the periphery and Italy-German spreads and so on. But we found it funny that the president of the EU thought that she was the one that had the leverage over Italy, which is kind of remarkable when you look at the composition of the sovereign debt on the ECB's balance sheet. Like Ira was saying, as soon as we start going quantitative tightening, I mean, there's no buyers for that garbage other than the ECB. And so this is going to be fascinating to watch. You know, the old expression, if you owe the bank a billion, it's their problem. Italy has ECB right where it wants it. It's been able to charge off their lifestyle on the German credit cards. And now the bills come due, they get to socialize the losses. And it's that's the only thing I would add, is we found it very, very funny when she was threatening the Italian population to vote correctly. Ursula, I always forget her last name, but
Ursula von der Leyen.
Yes. Yes,
and that's, so now we got a government. So you've got all these problems in Italy, and I think the Italians, they need to keep Draghi around, because Draghi is the only, you know, he's Archimedes' lover, because he knows where all the skeletons are, and there are a lot of skeletons in Europe. And it's interesting that Macron gets a little quieter here, even France, so with EDF, although it was interesting that EDF now, you know, announced that they were with Cameco purchasing Westinghouse for the reactor technology. So that's, but there's many things going on in Europe. And I'm glad we're at this point, because, you know, I keep hearing, and I'd like to hear your views on it. We keep hearing everybody's applauding how good the strong dollar is for U.S. inflation. Yeah, and it's been my view that because everything is priced in dollars, no, it's not like that, because what the United States imports is minimus, especially in terms of that, because it's already priced in dollars. The only way a strong dollar benefits the United States is if a strong dollar, because of the massive amount of debt that overhangs the global economy, if the strong dollar, which raises the cost of carrying that debt, forces the world into a deflationary slowdown. And I mean a deflationary slowdown. So we're talking about what a slowdown is going to be. Outside of that, I just don't see the dollar as being this great thing that people are talking about, because it's not like the 70s. Everybody wants to go back to the 70s. It's not like the 70s, because the dollar had a different role. Today, the dollar is much more a finance mechanism than it is trade, especially from the U.S. perspective. It's the major linchpin of the global financial system. And as the dollar rises, and U.S. interest rates are going up, it's a double whammy. So I don't view that. Am I missing something?
So I would only say we've made this point before, which is there's actually a significant difference to the 1970s. Certainly, the dollar plays a different role, but also the energy shortage of the 70s was caused by a political crisis, which means a political resolution was always on the table. Here we have a capital crisis, in the sense that we've not invested in fossil fuels, and the rising of the interest rates and the strengthening of the dollar makes the incremental investment less appealing. You know, the shale revolution was financed on cheap, easy money and low interest rates and plentiful liquidity, and all that is gone. And so since we have a molecule crisis, not a political crisis, the pathway out is going to be very different than what we experienced in the 70s. And so our view is that this is a pretty unique situation. There's some things you could learn about what happens in such markets from the 70s. But the big difference is, you know, you could have flown to the Middle East and cut a deal back then. You can't cut a deal with capital not invested. The best time to have done that investment was 5 years ago, and the second best time is now. But there's still not very much urgency to support the necessary investments in primary energy that we need to get ourselves off the mat.
Is that why you believe the Saudis are taking the stance that they're? I mean, I think there's several pieces to that in the world of international political economy, but that they understand that far better than the U.S. and they go, your leverage, you know, is minimus because you still have the problem whether you want to beat up on us or not.
Well, I would say, look, no Saudi expert. Our view of the situation is there's a deep personal animosity between the two men, between Joe Biden and MBS. And sometimes Occam's razor works in the sense that the simplest explanation is the one you should go with. I just think they don't like each other. And I think the OPEC plus cut of 2 million barrels a day was to put the screws to the Biden administration ahead of the election and to embarrass him ahead of the election. And I don't doubt for a second that the Saudis would prefer Donald Trump back in office or, you know, a Republican majority in Congress. And I think Biden doesn't trust MBS and as you know, listen, Jack, we still call the shots around here and we'll see. Over time, you know, but that's what I think is going on. I think, you know, we've alienated a lot of people around the world, Chinese and the Russians and now the Saudis. They may very well have deserved our ire, but there are consequences to doing that as well. And as we've long been saying, it's not like Putin doesn't have any cards to play, and he's played them. And played them to, I think, significant effect, at least relative to what the initial expectations were. I'm old enough to remember when Biden said the sanctions would turn the ruble into rubble, and the reverse has happened. And so, you know, we shall see. But I do think personal animosity between MBS and Biden is real, which means, you know, at least for the next 2 years and change, I wouldn't necessarily look for a detente in the relationship. Although, at the same time, too, I would suspect that. MBS probably has his, he's probably being very careful about his, you know, domestic front and the grip, the security of the grip that he holds on power. Let's put it that way.
What do you make of the, of a potential reserve currency shift, you know, given all these trends in US dollar, the sanctions, the energy markets, your views on that?
Is that to me or to our?
To Bloomberg, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly in the background. You know, the Saudis are looking to, you know, well, you have the BRICS countries, right? Brazil, Russia, India, China, South America. If you add Saudi Arabia to that, you have a pretty powerful set of energy producers and large consumers and significant workforce. And so, you know, Luke Groman's been writing about this for a long time. That is probably the ultimate sort of high level battle of the background that's going on. And if the Saudis have good and decided that they're no longer going to be the main cog in the US dollar sort of petrodollar system, then I think we should take note of it and ponder the consequences.
Yeah. Your thoughts, Ira?
Oh, no, I was, you know, listen, I discussed that with Zoltan, who put out that, you know, a couple powerful pieces about it. I think it's coming because it makes sense because, you know, the dollar's going up. Not because the United States is a responsible actor, by the way, I don't buy it. And real yields in the U.S., of course, are still negative because I look at the short end of the curve. If you want to battle inflation, you beat inflation, as Paul Volcker showed, at the short end, at the over. That's where you have to go. And actually, as you know, I've talked about, Powell was pretty honest about that because it was the last question at the last press conference when. What's your name? From Market News, I think, asked a question about real yields. And he said they would ideally like to get short-term rates, the Fed funds rate, to a real 1% yield. So if inflation is 6%, they ought to go to 7%. Well, you know, that would be somewhat of a Taylor type rule, which would be interesting. I don't think that they're going to get there. And so, and as we're talking about this, yesterday an article in the Washington Post, of all places, discusses the growing amount of the interest cost on the U.S. debt. Because don't forget, we built up to $30 trillion, $31 trillion, we're playing with the number, at zero interest rates. Now the overnight rate is approaching 3.5%. Well, we're at 3.75%, soon to be at 3.75% if the market's right. I'm looking at the December Fed funds. So we're going to be at 4%. And this is in a Washington Post article of all places. I know I have it. Wait, hold on one second. No, I can't, but it was out yesterday and it was a really interesting article. I think I know who wrote it, but it was, and that's a very important thing, by the way. Nobody's talking about it. I don't know how this is not a mainstay of the election. In fact, the Washington Post put it in there that it's growing 50%. So we're going to go from, I think the number was $389 billion in interest costs for 21-22, and 22-23 jumps to about $550 billion. Well, as I discussed with my friend Kevin McCarthy all the time, who's one of the best global analysts that I know, what happens when the interest on the debt exceeds the defense budget? This has been an issue that I don't know that we've ever been at, but it's coming, because if the Fed is going to fight this fight with interest rates, there's no getting around it. And the political decisions, the decisions about discretionary spending, about all these other things, are really going to make the coming politics. If you think you've seen acrimony in this country in the last 3, 4, 5, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, wait until you really have to start cutting programs, because the cost on financing the entire debt has run out of control. And that calls into the question the dollar. People are, I understand the momentum. Listen, I'm a trader, and I've been trading foreign exchange pretty successfully for 46 years almost now. My academic background is in it by happenstance, but I see what's going on here. And the dollar is, there's no, the only fundamental, there's two fundamentals driving the dollar higher. One is the weakness of Europe, and the two is the fact that the United States is on the path of at least getting to positive real yields. And it's a powerful statement. Can they get there? We shall see. I think they're gonna, we have an election coming up. So it's be interesting to see what the Fed does at the November meeting. You know, everybody, I think we're 95% priced in, 95% probability of a 75 basis point hike. But it's not that the United States is being a fiduciary for the system. They're not. They just look better for the moment. And that can change in like that. That can change, which is why the metals are still an interesting story for me. They're getting beat up, as they should. There's no surprise there, because as you move closer to a zero real yield, the metals come under pressure.
Yeah, go ahead. You have thoughts, Duberg?
Yeah, I agree. I think also, again, as we were big fans of Luke Roman, and he's been pointing out the fact that as the Fed hikes rates and tries to sort of bring inflation under control, that necessarily is going to hit asset prices, and that's going to shrink GDP, which is going to put pressure on receipts as well. So it's not just the growing obligation of the US government to pay interest on the debt, which of course is substantial and grows with each hike, but also the means by which they can afford to pay that back are shrinking because of the potential recession that we might be facing. And so then you're essentially talking about either interest rates, basically the cost of the money, cost of interest takes over most of the budget, or the Fed has to back down. We shall see.
We've talked a lot about energy and resources. Just wondering your thoughts, Doomberg, on the risks of resource nationalism, you know, like forbidding exports of resources, energy. I mean, we've seen the effects of Gazprom as an investment. What are your thoughts on resource nationalism and associated government policies, like could be windfall profit tax, on investing, on the investing environment, like investing in oil and gas companies?
So one of the things we wrote about in one of our prior pieces was when we rolled out the anti-logic framework, which is you can count on the current slate of Western leaders to make the worst possible decision at every opportunity. We predicted that there would be price caps, rationing, and also protectionism within Europe. So we mentioned earlier that, you know, various countries have different amounts of natural gas they can store. Just because natural gas is stored in a country doesn't mean that it is earmarked to be used in that country. And one wonders whether if things got really bad, the countries with excess storage might force majeure their obligations and protect that home. And similarly with Norway, and I know, in fact, we've heard from people who would know that one of the driving forces for Germany keeping the nuclear power plants on was their fear that their neighbors might not help them as much as they might need if they're going to be so stupid as to follow through with this insane policy decision. And you know, the threat of protectionism certainly was at least a thumb on the scale in this reversal. And we shall see, you know, will Habeck, will he resign from the German government because of this, you know, what he would consider a slap in the face. You know, he gave a very emotional speech just a couple of days ago, you know, saying that nuclear was the problem, if you can believe it. Like, this, I don't know how they find these politicians, but you know, probably the dumbest thing we've ever seen a politician say. And with Trudeau on the board, that's saying a lot. And you know, it's just remarkable the you know, they say these things enough times that I guess they come to believe it. I mean, they just convince themselves that it's true. And so we shall see. It's protectionism is how I would describe it. That's certainly a risk on the radar within Europe, let alone, you know, across the world. And then if we get to this multipolar world where energy is settled in one currency amongst the US allies and it's settled in a different currency amongst the rest of the world, then, you know, how do you arbitrage between the two? There's all kinds of really uncharted territory to get into here. You know, like I have plenty of friends who I like to catch falling the eyes and bought Russian stocks on the dirt cheap and all their accounts are frozen and they can't get out of their position. Well, that's political intervention. Like, those companies are still worth something, but you know, if you can't sell it, it's worth zero. And so I see Ira's raising his hands. Yeah.
I've actually been in there for years. I've owned the Moscow energy company, which, you know, the dividends have been great, you know, and I bought it for, and I've been in, you know, the ETF. So, you know, and I look at it, it's not like I haven't, you know, you couldn't buy anything and I haven't bought any rubles. As I watched it go to 138, and I watched Jen Psaki, who's now the second greatest lawyer in the world, when she looks at you and said, you know, as you said, you know, the ruble, she was, the ruble is rubble. Yeah, I know, it's rubble. But you know, I look at it and I go, well, if you really wanted to deplete Putin's treasury, make them pay out all those dividends that they owe everybody in the world. That would be more money outflow than any insurance costs, which, after we finish this, I want to ask you a question about that.
And like, for one example would be like Petrobras in Brazil. How do you see that playing out with government policies, the elections, that they pay out a high dividend now? Could that the same type of scenario happen as with Gazprom or something similar?
I'll leave that one for Ira, because I'm not real big on individual stocks, but curious to get your views.
No, I'm not really. So, you know, it'll be interesting if they were to reach some kind of at least ceasefire, how they would deal with this. And I don't know the answer. I don't know. I'm locked up like everybody else. I mean, I don't have a lot of money invested in it. It was more a play on Europe. You know, I understood the flow of cheap natural gas. They needed it. You know, and I've been so aware of the Gerhard Schroeder. And because I knew I was coming on with you, I reread the last chapter of Petrostate yesterday morning. And it's so hard to believe that people who are in policymaking positions could get caught so badly with this. When these things have been written about by high quality thinkers, I'm not talking about, you know, people like Peter Navarro, or people, hey, I'm not talking about people. I'm talking about a guy like Marshall Goldman, who's, they treat, you know, again, you know, if you're from Harvard, they, of course, they always have to put the Harvard sign behind you, like everybody at Harvard is so brilliant. I've lived long enough to know that myth is one of the great myths that exists in the world. But, you know, or as they say, the statue of the three lies, everything about Harvard is the three lies. Although there are a lot of high quality people there, but it irritates me at some points. But you do see this play out, and it's playing out pretty much as Marshall Goldman wrote in a book, you know, Petrostate in 2008. It's really all there, and other people have seen it too. So there's really no surprises here. You know, how you invest, it's now up in the air because you're going to have to see the way certain things are settled out. You know, I could see the board. And again, it's the difference between, you know, practice and theory, or as my company, which is now I gave to a group of discretionary traders who I have great respect for, praxis. That's what the Eastern communists, the Eastern European Marxists, love to throw it around, and I know it comes from Gramsci, but praxis. And you know, everything is in you can take all the theory you want, but how does it really affect out in the world? Or as Deng Xiaoping, when he turned China from Mao and Mao's two whatevers, he said, practice is the sole criterion for judging truth. And that was what really turned China. Because it went from being theoreticians to, he was tired of it. He says, don't tell me what you theoretically think. How does it play out in practice? And you know what? I think Doomberg does that as well as anybody, by the way. I think that's why you guys have climbed to number one, because you forget the theoretical. It's nice in which to look at it, but Doomberg presents a great model always to understand what's really going on in the energy markets. And I think that's where we're at. But I want to ask one question. Something that fell off the radar screen pretty quickly, which tells me, and I can't stand conspiratorial theorists. Again, you know, that's in the realm, in the netherworld and in the world, ether world of theoreticians, because you can grab onto what you want. But who blew up that pipeline? And the reason I ask, and I know we talked about it last time, and I talked about it with Dr. Alhaji, into trying to understand how these caps are going to work that Janet Yellen and company are busy throwing out there. Now, I finally came to understanding last week, going, it's all predicated upon the ability to ship Russian energy. And if you can't insure these ships, well, then Russia is going to really have to discount it, so those caps will come into being. So it makes it question. So who blew up that pipeline? Because we know that if you can't ship by pipeline, you have to ship by ship. Who is responsible for that, in your opinion?
Yeah, I don't really have a view. You know, we wrote a piece where all we did was say that we don't know, because we literally don't know. How can anybody know?
Right.
And then we just hypothesized that what if, you know, because, you know, the standard sort of mainstream line is Putin blew up his own pipelines, which we always thought was a bit strange. I suppose it's possible. But let's just imagine in a hypothetical that he didn't. There's only sort of two things you could know. You could know that you blew up the pipelines. And when I say you, I mean a country.
Or you could
be a country that knows it didn't blow up the pipelines itself. And so then we hypothesized that, what if Putin didn't do it? And they pinned the blame on him. Because then you're talking about a double whammy. Like he not only has this, you know, decabillion dollar investment destroyed in a matter of minutes, but also then is pinned with blame. We argued in the piece that uncomfortably brought forward the prospects of potential nuclear war. And, you know, we're anti-war. We're certainly anti-nuclear war. We're pro-peace. That used to not be a controversial thing. Although if you tweet it today, you're accused of being borderline treasonous. You know, we would prefer to live in a world where countries got along. And yes, there are dangerous people in the world and they have to be dealt with. But we did point out that if Putin didn't destroy these pipelines and we pin the blame on him, we're not leaving him with too many options. And if he is sort of the madman dictator that he's been made out to be, then that seems like a pretty serious situation and ups the risk curve substantially.
Really, very good points. And again, I don't know, but it was a story that died as fast as it came on. It died that fast, which I found fascinating, because if Putin had in fact done it, they would have been parading it. And who, you know, as somebody else pointed out, I think you guys may have picked up on that, who has the technology to be able to do that? You know, though it's not like those, you know, that Richard and I are going, you know, deep sea diving and going to blow up some underwater gas lines. No, that's not going to happen. And to be able to, I don't know, it is. And you bring up that really good point. But, you know, we go back to what Biden had to say. You know, everybody attacked Biden when he was talking about the nuclear tactical nuclear war. I don't think he used that, but he talked about nuclear war being close. And then he followed it up with, and we have to provide an off-ramp, which some people try to, but you do have to provide an off-ramp. You know, everybody's got to set their ego aside and figure, you know, this has been nine, you know, how many months? Almost nine, going on 9 months of absolute insanity, as far as I'm concerned, because the two things that they were talking about that crept into the news were, you know, that Putin, you know, supposedly Putin wanted this and that. He wanted a guarantee, yet again, that Ukraine would not be part of NATO, which is kind of interesting, because if you could have given him that in January, why didn't you give him that in January? And I forgot what the second thing was, but we still exist in this realm, but we've unleashed a lot of elements that play to Putin and actually reveal a world that not necessarily anybody in America from the foreign policy establishment should be so so proud of.
Yeah, you know, only thing I would add is we try real hard to only write about stuff where we have differentiating knowledge and to resist the temptation to speculate, which is why we didn't speculate in that piece.
Yep.
And one of the things we found kind of interesting is just how many people were so quick to not only judge who did it, but to say it out loud.
Right.
And you know, this is the, but now of course, when you do such a thing, people read onto the paper words that aren't there, and they assume that because you're not saying their opinion, you must be opposed to it. And that's another interesting phenomenon. But if we don't have like something differentiating to add to it, what do we know about the technical abilities needed to blow up a pipeline? Now, of course, I know that I can't do it, and I suspect that neither of you two could do it. But I don't know, could Greenpeace do it? Could Poland do it? Could the UK do it? Could the US do it? No, it's who wants to live in a world where the US would blow up a pipeline like that? My preference would be that Putin did it out of some weird n-dimensional chess that I don't understand, because at least that would mean that we didn't do it. But you know, I have no knowledge to add that weighs the scale. And like everybody else, when we don't have expertise, we're just interested readers.
Yeah, no, me too. And the role of insurance in global shipping is far bigger than what people think. And when I listen to Yellen keep explaining this in the G7 with their G7 and G20 statements, it shows you how much dissension there is in the upper levels of the world pecking order. I mean, they are really at wit's end. The G20 was, I mean, they couldn't even put out, they tried to put out a communique. It was a joke, and it's so unusual, but they're at odds with each other because everybody else is at odds. You know, India has needs, China has needs, Japan has needs, every individual country. And as long as we still use the Westphalian model of the nation state being the preeminent force, they're going to, and again, if you believe in democracy, and democracy's linchpin is the nation state, you're going to have to adhere to what's best for your electorate. You know, and that goes for Germany too. And Germany is making that decision because people are saying, turn on those damn reactors. You know what? We can all be philosophers when our stomachs are full. Everybody's a philosopher when your stomach's full and you're sitting in your nice warm house. But when those things start to change, politics change with it.
And in terms of last question topic, we discussed last time, Dunberg, on the idea of fertilizer companies, you know, making fertilizer from natural gas, especially in North America, at lower prices of natural gas, shipping to Europe as an interesting way to consider. Any thoughts there? And also, do you think that it makes more sense on infrastructure consulting engineering firms like ABB or Schlumberger, you know, in the energy sector for investment considerations?
Yeah, hard for us to give specific stock recommendations. As we said very clearly, you know, we don't do investment advice and we leave it to the professionals and we're not licensed and we hold no licenses and we're not financial advisors. And so, you know, we'd like to try to figure out who's going to make money, which is a valuable piece of information for people to know, and then let traders and professionals insert that into their own work process so they can understand. The spread that you referred to has certainly come in since we last talked. It's still pretty large. You know, the price of natural gas in the US is $6.50 today and 33 or so in Europe. You know, you're talking about five times the difference. And so that's a very healthy spread compared to historical margins. And so companies like, you know, CF Industries and so on are going to be making a lot of money. Whether this is all now fully priced in by the market, you would think after this time that, you know, people would have figured that out. And also, I do think where we like to play, and where, if some of your listeners are perhaps accredited investors with some private deal flow, the private companies have a chance to make a lot of money a lot quicker because they don't have the ESG pressures, or, you know, with the Larry Finks of the world breathing down their back, and the divest fossil fuel movements. So, you know, there's probably going to be substantial opportunities in the private sector to monetize that spread. In the long run, all arbitrage closes, and this one will close too. And as we said early on in this podcast, that's going to be a whole new world, and we'll see who the big winners are in that space.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
No, I can't say it any better. And you know what? I love what he says, you know, because again, they're not really, Dunberg's not selling anything. All they're doing is selling their ideas and knowledge, and let you take it to where you want to take it to, you know, and I've always, you know, I always loved that. When I used to do a lot of Santelli hits, you know, and Rick and I used to talk about it all the time. I'm not selling anything. I'm not selling a fund. I'm not selling that. All I'm doing is selling, hopefully, good discussion in order to get you. And that's like when we start talking about the European bond markets, nobody out there is talking about the European bond markets. And you should be paying attention to them. Then you have a steepening curve versus an inverting curve. And it should cause others like Janet Yellen, maybe the dollar's gone a little too strong. You know, don't, you know, they get into that Larry Kudlow mindset of King Dollar. You know what? It doesn't mean what you think it means from a model of 1970, you know. And, you know, and I always go to war against the modelers because it has to, everybody then bias fits it to fit their model. And then when the models really don't become as predictive as they're selling, everybody's scratching their head, why? And through Dunberg, and again, you know, one of my favorite, and this podcast from FRA does it really well, but as Louis Gavet says it better than anybody, And this is where Doomberg fills the puzzle in. My clients don't pay me to predict, they pay me to adapt. And when you think about things through and you have good, and you're forced to think outside your comfort zone, your ability to adapt becomes much better. If you're married to a concept, like, oh, don't fight the Fed, it's a nice statement. Great, buy in May and go, or sell in May and go away, whatever you want. But then you lock yourself into a box. I don't lock myself in a box because everything is always different. And you know what? And nothing says it more than here we exist in this time. And now what's the biggest discussion taking place? Is the Treasury possibly going to buybacks? Because again, we are in the middle of an election. And I still say, watch the Fed here, because the Fed is very attentive about that. This is an election period too. And don't tell me that the Fed's not political. That's a myth that was probably propagated at Jekyll Island in 1913, only because was a far better politician than most of the people we have around now. But don't tell me they're not political. And with the, and again, it's interesting that this fell out of the discussion, because Powell spent two Fed press conferences discussing, what is the impact of the dollar on a tightening basis? Meaning, if the dollar goes up 15%, what is that an equivalency of interest rate rises just as quantitative tightening? And he threw out 25 basis points. On the rise in the dollar, we didn't hear anything. We heard it discussed. So maybe that they're tighter than they think they are. Maybe. But the strong dollar is causing havoc around the globe. It is, because again, the dollar on an international basis is a finance instrument. Stop looking at it through the prism of U.S. trade, because the only way the U.S. benefits is if the economy goes into a deep recession. Then everybody will be throwing goods onto the market, just like China was doing when China's had too much capacity and they were producing too much, and they were pushing all those goods onto the global market, allowing all the central banks to think that they had really tamed inflation. So that's where we're sitting. But really, I love being with Doomberg, because that's what they're pushing. Think about things and try to put the puzzle together. And that's how you're going to make profits.
Yeah, appreciate the kind words, and appreciate the repeat appearance. Richard, it's been great. I would say, just in closing, we try to limit ourselves to what we do well. And we're really privileged to have found what it is that we're supposed to be doing in life through the success of the Substack, which has really blown away our own wildest expectations or hopes. We have achieved personal sovereignty. Our definition of wealthy is that you can make more than enough money to satisfy your needs doing only what you love all day. And we have carved out a life where we can do that. We control the denominator. A lot of people spend too much time on the numerator, how much money they're making versus the denominator, which is how much you're spending. The old phrase is, if your outflow is greater than your inflow, then your upkeep will be your downfall. And so we try to manage the outflow as well. And so we are 100% subscriber supported. We do have something to sell, which is subscriptions to Doomberg. Every subscriber is precious. We have many thousands of them. We don't take sponsorships, nor do we take advertisers. Not that there's anything necessarily wrong with those models, but given the provocative nature with which we would like to write, we felt that having 100% editorial freedom to do so was on brand for us. And so that's why we declined all sponsorship offers as we grew and decided to go with a subscriber model. So 100% subscriber supported, doomberg.substack.com if you haven't already checked us out. We tried to price it competitively, and this is truly the work of our lives. And gentlemen, it was a great discussion.
Great. Thank you very much. And great insight from both, and words of wisdom from both Doomberg and Ira. Thank you so much.
Well, let me finish up with one thing, because, I sit here and I want to remind people it was November 4th. So exactly a year ago when Biden's, plan got approved, and he was touting that 17, Nobel Prize winners said that it would reduce inflation. I'm not talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, which was named after me, Ira. But and I had nothing to do with it, nor would I ever have anything to do with it. But it did say reduce inflation. So, you know, I remind people, and I will tell people, we're going into the election. So if you're a trader and you're, and as you'll see doomer analysis, be very aware that, especially as we started out talking, right? We got another reduction in this, in the petroleum reserve, strategic petroleum reserve. So beware of the optics. The Democrat polling now is diminishing great. And everything I say is nonpartisan. I love that about Doomer. I believe Doomberg is one of the most nonpartisan. If you read partisanship into it, that's your problem, not theirs. And I think that's a really good thing. And you can tweet with it all you want, as he amply said. But be very aware that there is going to be stuff coming out of the White House, because they are trying to affect optics. It's all about the optics. The Strategic Petroleum Reserve announcement is pure optics, because they're doing everything they can to get pump prices down. Unfortunately, the Republicans in their diminished mental capacity fails to talk about the much higher utility bills that we pay, right? Because Biden told us we were going to experience pain by supporting Ukraine, and which meant shipping a hell of a lot of LNG to Europe. So, I mean, we have had a structural change there. We are shipping so much so that, again, as we started out, the storage is, so be very aware and be on your toes for optics. And it may be that you might hear something from Janet Yellen, because she's getting pushed at, and you could see something on the dollar, because the strong dollar is wreaking havoc. And if you want to get the equity market to get some sense of a near-term rally, bring the dollar down, and interest rates, I think, would soften. I'm talking about overnight rate. Everybody keeps watching the long end. It's not the long end. If you're in an inflation fight, it takes place on the short end, and that's seeking your inner Volcker. So that's where I rely.
Great. Thank you very much, Doomberg and Ira. Thank you so much. Take care.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.